guys. This is K2 Romeo India Whiskey. And the time to be in the TechNet, as we've done for quite a number of years, 35 and a half years. Main purpose of the TechNet is education. Curious radio amateurs get together and teach each other the inner secrets of wireless technology. Antennas and transmission lines and feed lines and transmitters, receivers, and propagation, and 26 different kinds of ham radio. And the one you're listening to right now, FM 2-meter repeater ham radio, except for the IRLP and Echo Link and everything else that's connected to this machine, chat room and so on. It's just one of the methods of ham radio hobby, carrying it out. We're about to find out if everybody is on vacation this weekend and nobody's around to sign into the TechNet. We'll soon find out if there's anybody around. Let me drop. This will be TechNet number 1701. Yeah. You'll also be hearing Science and Physics Report number 31 from Dr. Roy, AC2GS. You'll be hearing Space Report number 301 from Paul, WS2N. The TechNet is broken up into three sections. The first section is people signing in with questions or comments. Let me take those in order. That's followed by AC2GS with the Science and Physics Report. And that's followed by Paul, WS2N, with the Space Report. We'll find out what's the latest that National Aeronautics and Space Administration and the other space agencies of other countries around the world, what they're doing. Let me drop. So those three sections are the way we've been doing it for some time. And mailbag is in there also. In other words, people who write to Roy, AC2GS, with a question they want to put on the net, and they go to communicating to him by way of snail mail, internet, or whatever, because they don't have the right equipment to talk to us directly on the air or not around at that time. So there's various ways that they can get the message to Roy, and we can put it onto the net so the person's questions or comments can be addressed. Let me drop. Now, this net is intended to do what people desire. If you've got reasonably strong opinion and a good reason for it as to how we should do things differently, but certainly open to your suggestions. The way the TechNet is run, don't be afraid to ask what you think is a dumb question. From our point of view, the dumb question is the one most deserving of an answer. So we don't have that elitist attitude, if you know what I mean. Okay, and so as I said, if you have suggestions as to how you think should be done differently, make your opinions known to any of the three people above by any of the means you want to communicate with them with. Okay, so we're about to find out if anybody's here. If everybody's not on vacation, they're going to sign in with their call letters and their name and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. A typical sign-in would sound like this. AC2GS, Roy, and yes. So, do we have anyone to sign in with a question or a comment? Please give me your call letters and name right now after the three beeps. K2RAW listening.
WA2RYY, Joe, yes.
Very fine. We got Joe. Anyone else?
M, yes.
Okay, something M. Give us that call letters again. Now, we got nothing but the M, I'm sorry to say. Go ahead. Squeeze the mic, wait a second, then give us all the information, sir. What's your name?
KC1, Sierra Alpha Mike. Sam, yes.
We got you, Sam. KC1, Sierra Alpha Mike. Okay. So we got Joe, Sam. Anyone else? Wait for the beeps and give me your call letters and name right now if you've got a question or a comment. One more call. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet with even a dumb question? Give me your call letters right now and name. K2RIW listening. Okay? Maybe somebody will sign in a little bit later. And maybe we'll have a light night tonight and sign off a little early. The TechNet often runs 4 hours, but maybe it'll be a little bit more brief. So, Joe, W-H-Y-Y, what you been up to lately? And how are those television DX? I'm very envious of you having that great system where you're able to do digital television DX. So I wonder what kind of very long signals you've been hearing lately. W-H-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W, you got it, Joe.
Well, the question isn't about TV DX, but I'll just tell you what I recently got. It was actually very funny because it was a low-power digital station in Port Jervis, what supposedly comes back to. I don't know what their actual transmitter is. And one low-power station in New York City, which I never get, except when I took a TV portable with me into New York City, Channel 12. So it must have been the conditions with that front coming in, the cold front of, like, yesterday. Yesterday was Friday night or Saturday night, it would have been 26th. And that was kind of unusual. It got down the call list, and I looked up where the station's up. But anyway, that's not my question. I have a non-RF question for you, if you want to entertain that.
As long as it's a subject of interest to ham radio operators, which involves a lot of subjects of science, physics, and so on, even astronomy, go right ahead, Joe.
Okay, Dick, very good. W-H-Y-Y. By what means does a smartphone work as far as the screen, being able to do things on the screen, like bringing up a keyboard and being able to touch it with your finger to do stuff, but yet something else like the tip of a pen or a short, sharpened stick will not make that smartphone work. I've heard you have to use something like a stylus, but I'm not sure what a stylus actually is composed of. I've seen them in the store. They seem to resemble something with either a metal or a plastic shaft with a rubberized tip at the end. But by what means does a smartphone work where it seems to recognize your finger primarily? The reason I'm asking is because these newer smartphones are pretty small, and it's kind of hard to type with your finger. You end up hitting like multiple keys or the key right next to what your intent is, and I thought of using something like a small pointed device, but I can't seem to find something that will actually activate those keys on the phone screen once you have that particular app brought up. Back to you, Dick.
I'm not positive that every smartphone does it this way, but a hell of a lot of those touch screen displays really have a whole bunch of transparent patches, metallic, conductive, transparent patches right behind the forward piece of glass on that screen. And they are a proximity detector. In other words, there is a high frequency put onto each of those patches. And when something of significant capacitance is put near one of those patches, the circuit senses that capacitance. Your finger has got a significant amount of capacitance. The tip of your finger held near one of those patches with that short distance of spacing between the thin layer of glass up front is something close to a 100 picofarad capacitor. So there's a high frequency sine wave, I think it is, maybe a square wave, put on those patches. And when the patch becomes loaded down by that 100 picofarad capacitance to you, a grounded object, it senses that and says, hey, Joe is pointing at the patch number 45. And that's right under the letter G. And so it types out the letter G for you. So proximity detector capacitive sensing. When you put a stick or other objects near that same point, it doesn't have anywhere near the area of the tip of your finger. Your finger also has a hell of a lot of moisture inside of it. You are a very conductive, highly capacitive object, that finger plus the rest of your body that's connected to that finger. Whereas many of the objects you would be pointing to that point with is not creating that amount of capacitance, therefore it doesn't fire that circuit. That's my belief as to how it works. Now, they probably make a specific stylus, which has a long conducting rod down the center, and something near the tip that'll give them that amount of capacitance so that it will sense that. But I think a pencil might not do it. Many other objects might not do it. Drag your feet in case there are people who are smarter than I am, who know how a proximity detector really works and can fill us in on that. And those patches in there that are conductive but transparent, I think they're tin oxide, but there I'm not absolutely sure. W-A-2-R-Y-Y to take it with some delay. K-2-R-I-W in the tech net. Go right ahead, Eric.
I wanted to point out that there's actually two different kinds that are used in the cell phones. One is capacitive. And by the way, it's laid out like a matrix, so that way it knows what position it does, row and column. The other type is resistive, and the resistive ones are the newer ones that actually determine the pressure at which you press on it. You'll find some of the newer phones have the ability to read the pressure and either make the dot bigger or smaller if you're drawing. There's a lot of applications for it.
Interesting stuff, Eric. By the way, Eric, your audio is a little bit low. You have to shout into that microphone just a little bit louder. So some of them are resistive, and you change the resistance by pressing on that part of the screen, and it knows how much pressure you're giving it. So interesting. So and it's got rows and columns, so it knows you're pressing row number 5 and column number 3, and therefore that's the letter G, as I gave an example before. Pretty crafty. So it looks like we've somewhat pinned down how a smartphone touch screen seems to be operating, Joe. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W, the TechNet. And when I pass it back to you, do you know who was the major inventor of a cell phone? Over to you, Joe.
I believe it was a guy by the name of... I can't really recall his name. They're Ham. I think it was back in the 60s and 70s. There was another station underneath you. Whoever that other station was, pick it up.
C2GS here.
Go right ahead, Roy. And you probably have a lot of familiarity with touchscreens, so tell us what you know on that subject, or any other subject you want to talk about. You've got it, Dr. Roy.
Okay, as Eric said, there's basically two types of touch controls. There's resistive, which is, I think, actually older than capacitive, and capacitive. Most cell phones these days use capacitive coupling, and it's not that difficult to find a probe that works for it. I bought some things from China, and they threw in some styluses. They're basically impregnated by carbon-conducting rubber. So they conduct electricity, and they give some capacitive coupling to the contact point. It's not that difficult. They're dirt cheap, and they work as good as you would expect them to. The pressure-sensitive ones are a little bit more esoteric these days, things like Wacom tablets that let you draw, that can tell the angle you're putting the pen and the pressure is a little bit more involved than just purely resistive information.
W-H-Y-Y. Yeah, I stopped in Staples, for example, as a store, just one store I tried. And they seem to have styluses different than what I saw a couple of years ago in another store, Best Buy. The ones they have now are close to a quarter inch in diameter, maybe 3/16 in diameter. But I sort of saw styluses years ago that were much, much thinner, like about an eighth inch diameter, that were very pointy. The ones they have now seem to resemble the rounded end of a pencil eraser. Like if you took a pencil eraser and just made it round, they're about almost that size, which is kind of defeats the purpose of what I'm looking for, because my finger is not much bigger than that. I'm trying to find something that makes it easier to type or hit keys on a smartphone when you're trying to type something like some information, because the typical problem I have is I keep on hitting the letter right next to it. So I just thought there might be an easy way to get around it by having something pointed like a stylus or something. I guess I have to just explore this a little more, maybe do some internet checking. I thought of just throwing the thing on the internet, on the net, but to begin with, maybe somebody else knows a little bit more about it than I do. Back to you.
Most of the designs that I've seen for capacitive touch screens have a kind of a, they look like the eraser, the end of an eraser, but you should still be able to punch out the buttons. It's only about a quarter of an inch in diameter, and that should be sufficient to get as much control as you'd pretty much want with a series of numbers on a number pad or a keypad. I've seen people use them, so it's probably doable.
Well, in a particular application, a particular smartphone I just started using, it's not mine, it's another application, I don't own it, but the keys are only about maybe an eighth inch in width, somewhere around that figure, maybe eighth inch, maybe about an eighth inch, I think they seem to resemble, and my finger is much bigger than that, so when I hit one thing like an E or something, whatever's next to it, sometimes I get the right letter or number, sometimes they get the one next to it. So I was looking for something smaller. It's definitely smaller than a quarter inch across.
Hey, that's very odd. I've never seen controls like that. They're very poorly designed, I would imagine. Let me ask a foolish question. Did you try rotating the screen 90 degrees and seeing if the image increases in size?
Yes, it does make the keys a little bigger. Basically, when you take the phone and flip it 90 degrees, everything just goes long ways, like, I guess you'd call it portrait instead of landscape type of scenario as far as display. It makes them a little bigger, but not too terribly much.
Hey, I thought it might help, but that's a very strange description of a design. I have seen many applications on many cell phones, and I can't recall one where the individual control devices are an eighth of an inch away from each other. That would drive me insane. So I wish you luck.
Well, what it does in a particular application, if you hit something like you want to put a comment in a particular line, once you touch on the line for the comment, then you get the comment going up slightly, and you have a keyboard, just like a computer keyboard, appear on the smartphone. And that's what I'm talking about. If you hold the phone vertically, they're squished together, and the numbers and letters are very small in width. They become slightly bigger if you turn the phone 90 degrees, but then you lose some of the application on the top. It changes the way it displays things. And I just thought, in simplicity, something pointed would be much better. So are you trying to transfer on top of me?
Interference on the signal. There are some things that you might want to try. I haven't tried them, but if you take something like a pencil and you wrap it up in tin foil, you might want to see if that does anything for you.
Unlike something like Google, they come up with different sizes or different material, how they're made, so forth, but I thought just bringing the topic just generally up to the net might be a first step in this learning process.
By the way, Dick, I think it's tin indium is the substrate that they use for these displays. They're conductive, but they're almost completely transparent, and that's the importance of rare metals like indium is necessary for things like this.
Yeah, we lost the audio on the output of the repeater for about 20 seconds during that transmission, and I think it's because we were told ahead of time that Eric, KE2EJ, is doing some service. Yep, that's him tapping on the tubes letting us know that he's doing some service right now, and that's why we lost the audio. I thought it was tin oxide, you think it's tin indium, but there is a nearly transparent conductive metal that makes up those little patches that allows you to capacitively sense, which I still think is the most popular one, because the resistor one, I can see how it can have many modes of failure. Remember the old so-called membrane keyboards that were on the very early candy computers. Some of those keyboards were very unreliable in a very short period of time, whereas the capacitive sensing ones are pretty good. Wrapping a pencil with tinfoil, I think, would do it quite well, particularly if there's a little tab of tinfoil at the tip that spread out a little bit. I think you'd get a very good stylus, a very pointy stylus that way, Joe. I think it's worth a try. W2RYY for any comments, K2RYW the TechNet.
No more, W2RY, no more comments for this round. You can give it to the next guy in line. I think this has been exhausted enough for the current time. But I said, if I have any other questions related to it, I'll of course bring them up at another time. W2RYY, back to you.
Point.
You got it right.
Okay, one of the big problems with resistive sensing is that you can't get multi-contact, you can't get gesture control. This is just the way of it's set up. It reads one resistance setting at a time. So the beauty of using capacitively sensed pressure panels is that you can do multi-touch and all kinds of gesture controls on it. And that's why cell phones seem to favor overwhelmingly capacitive screens.
The gesture control that you're now mentioning, I think that's where you put two, three, four fingers at a time on the screen and then spread the fingers out, and that will make the screen expand or contract. In other words, it senses the fact that there are multiple points of capacitive sensing, proximity sensing, that are spreading out, and therefore it adjusts the screen accordingly. It also allows you to wipe the screen where the multiple things either scroll up or scroll down. That's what I think you're talking about, and I see how that's a lot easier to do with the proximity capacitive sensing. Over to you for any comments on that, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Yes, exactly. Allows you to do zoom. It allows you to do the opposite. You can use two finger strokes, three finger strokes, top, bottom, sides. It does all kinds of cute things. And a lot of the pads have been building more and more esoteric gestures. And by the way, on Echo, UPS mentions that Joe should Google fine tip stylus, and he'd find lots of hits. He gave me an address, but it's a very, very long address. So my best advice, Visa K2UPS, would be to Google fine tip stylus. And I'm sure he'll come up with a lot of interesting things.
You just got this information from Rich, K2UPS. By what means, and did you just get that in the last few minutes? Roy, go ahead.
Yes, he's on EchoLink, but unfortunately his EchoLink connection has no microphone, so he can only listen. So he typed in the information.
So by EchoLink, he typed it in, and you saw it on your screen. Was that sort of like chat room? I mean, tell me how you were receiving his EchoLink typing. Give me some words on that, because as you can tell, I'm not much of a computer maven, Roy. Go ahead.
Okay, my desktop has three screens these days, and on the side screen, I'm running EchoLink, the software.
Okay, can you turn it over to me? I'm losing 375 again. Just drop it out.
We're running EchoLink, and there's a little text box at the bottom. I can send text to this little group that are listening to W2VLC.
KC1SAM to H4YY. I'm listening in both places at once. Eric is doing some sort of work there up at the main repeater site, and I think he's dropping a link to this repeater. That's why it comes and goes. Just be patient. He's working on it, okay?
And I have a browser. I could look up QRZ and all kind of fun stuff while this goes on. Not to mention...
Just let me know when I can pick it up with my sonar. And I just tried a hit of a nail on my phone, and it works. By the way, if that helps you out.
Yeah, the link is back.
You tried the head of a nail. How about the point of the nail?
The link is operating again right
no
now.
Good.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so...
There's got to be something made that I can find that'll do this. I'll just have to keep on just, you know, poking around, but I'm sure I'll find some sort of answer, like what the one guy said on coming from EchoLink. Maybe I should just try Googling fine point stylus on it. I might find some information that way. I might be cutting into the net because I'm transmitting on this frequency, and they're probably wondering who I'm talking to.
guys have concluded that a nail doesn't...
It's not my phone. It doesn't belong to me. It's, owned by somebody else, like a company.
Are you guys hearing me? They're holding a private conversation at the same time. So you concluded that there's not enough capacitance at the tip of a nail. A nail doesn't work as a stylus on these capacitive sensing. Is that what we've just concluded, K2LAW?
Yes, the, I'm sorry, so I was cutting over to 85, I'm sorry about that, but Sam was transmitting, I heard him when I come in, and I just replied back to him because there's no link going back the other way, so he just heard the whole system drop. Apparently he can't hear 85 directly, he's listening on 375. But anyway, he just made that comment. He said the head of the nail worked, but not the tip. Well, yeah, I sort of found that out. It's like, much larger in diameter. That's probably why it does. I'm looking for something pointy, or almost like a near point, 16th inch diameter point would solve my problem.
Let's see if Eric knows that the 375 link right now is not operational. KD2EJ, K2IW, you're familiar with that? We're not hearing anything on the 375, and we're getting some complaints on that. Over to you, Eric, if you're there.
Joe, if we're not interfering with them, I'll give you my suggestion. I wanted to pass it along.
Okay, seems like 375 is back in operation right now. And I think if you take the sharp tip of a nail and file it down so that it's a dull tip, I'll bet you can make a nail work. But we're also hearing that, I'm hearing Eric. Eric, you want to say something? Go ahead. Eric is doing service, and that's why 375 will be dropping out periodically. Looks like it's dropping out right now. Okay, Eric is, 375 is back in there. I think if you, first of all, people have suggested that if you Google the word stylus suggestions, you'll get a number of suggestions, but I think if you took a nail and filed down the sharp tip so that it's a dull tip, so that it gives you some more capacitance, I'll bet you can make a nail work. Give that a go, Joe. And when it comes to, in my opinion, one of the major inventors of the cell phone is the ham radio operator, Dr. Reed Fisher of Bell Laboratories, W2CQH, Whiskey 2, Charlie, Quebec Hotel. He was describing that research effort that was going on at Bell Laboratories to me when I was talking to him on 432 on multiple occasions around 1969. Whenever you Google who invented the cell phone, let me drop. You get the answer of Martin Cooper, a man from Motorola. Yes, he did make the first operational cell phone, and he did a photo opportunity. In other words, he gathered some news reporters standing in on a street in New York City and made a cell phone call to his favorite research guys at Bell Laboratories and said, I'm talking to you guys over a mobile telephone. Guess where I'm standing and guess who's watching me and so on. But in my opinion, Reed Fisher, who gets no credit, is one of the major inventors. And look what that developed into with these smartphones, among other things. The thing that's in people's pocket these days, boy, it's everything to them. It's their digital assistant, their computer, their list of telephones, their camera. It's a little bit, their internet connection, it's a little bit of everything. By the way, let me drop. The early cell phones used to have a little whip antenna sticking out of the top, and you would, it was a telescoping whip antenna. In order to get full coverage, you would pull that antenna up. Pretty soon, people realized that it worked almost as well if you didn't pull the antenna up, and all of a sudden, people were complaining about the fact that they were breaking off the antenna. So they forced the manufacturers to keep the antenna thoroughly internally. And at first you would think that that would lower the performance of the antenna. It turns out, and you've heard me guys talk about this often, the so-called infinitesimal dipole gives you full performance. When you squeeze that antenna down in size and force it to be inside the cell phone, if you're smart enough in the way you design it and the way you tune it, and there's usually a an antenna tuning operational, an antenna tuning integrated circuit right alongside of that antenna inside their cell phone. Let me drop. So even though that antenna has high Q and a very narrow bandwidth, it operates across that whole frequency region because it's got an antenna tuner connected to it, and it gives you full performance. So all of our cell phones these days have the antenna internally. Yeah, there was a time when Apple tried to build the antenna into the perimeter, a metallic perimeter on the phone, and then your fingers touching that perimeter was shorting out the antenna, so to speak, until they put an extra plastic coating over top of it. But we've gone through a lot of revolutions of that cell phone. Where's the antenna located? How much power output? How many frequencies does it go on? How many modes of operation? How many other functions built into it? There's something like 7.5 billion cell phones in operation right now on this earth. There's a little bit more cell phones in numbers than there are people. And there's a significant number of increase in the number of people who have access to a cell phone versus the number of people who have access to a working toilet. More people have access to a cell phone than a toilet. Craziness that we've given that object so much emphasis. Okay, the next person who signed in, hopefully he's hearing the link right now, which seems to be working. Let's see if Sam has got something to say. KC1, SAM, K2RIW. Go ahead, Sam.
Oh, KC1, SAM picking it up. Yeah, it's coming in very good now, but it's been dropping out. The only thing I wanted to say was, yes, if there was any comment suggestions. Mine would be, is it possible to have Paul's space report go second and then switch into the physics stuff in the games later? His is usually very, very interesting, and he gets kind of squeezed out. And the other, yeah, I always felt it's more important. Anyway, that's my suggestion. Any chance to go with the space report second and then the physics stuff third? If not, no big deal. But yes, the suggestions.
Okay. Let me ask Dr. Roy if he's willing to do that, to let the space report go next, which maybe will include information about the GOES 7 satellite, which is in synchronous orbit and giving them a little bit of a failure on their camera. So, Roy, are you willing to have the space report come before the science and physics report tonight? AC2GS, K2RIW, go ahead, Roy.
Yeah, Dick, I'm fine with that. And as an aside, I found out that there's a good news and bad news thing about the stylus. You can get a stylus that goes down to 1 millimeter of a surface. The only trouble is it has to be an active stylus that's powered internally rather than the passive styluses that require a broader contact area.
Do you know if there is a minimum contact area the stylus has to have in order to be passive and functional? Over to you, Roy.
Looks like to be a little bit above an eighth of an inch square, give or take. I haven't been able to find any specific measurements. I'm just judging from the way that they're advertising passive and active styluses.
So that if Joe would file down the tip of his nail, so the tip now becomes something close to an eighth of an inch in diameter, it might be functional as a highly pointed stylus, a passive stylus. And when we Google the word pointy stylus for operating with a cell phone, hopefully there are a number of websites that will give us some suggestions. So let's see if Paul is ready with space report number 301, I think it is. And I did read this week that the GOES satellite that was recently launched is getting a thermal failure of its cooling system for the camera, and therefore only on half of its orbit is it able to give the GOES satellite cloud coverage pictures. WS2N, K2RIW, go right ahead, Paul.
Very good, Dick. And yeah, okay, on GOES. And yeah, I can go any time with the report, either now or later. That's okay. But yeah, the GOES also has a problem with the next one that's going up. It would be called a GOES 17. and then it changes the name after it gets into orbit. But that the one that's still on the ground, they found some problems with, and they're looking into that. They might delay that launch. It was supposed to go up in 2019, and that might be delayed. But I don't think it's related to the other camera problem that the last ghost that was just launched has this WS-20.
K2LEG.
K2LEG, go right ahead with your comment, sir.
K2LEG, sorry, Dick, I checked in late, name is Cold Spring, New York. I have a technical question, can I wait to the end or what? Go ahead, thank you.
Okay, we've just switched over to the space report. We'll give a space report and then we'll come back to K2LEG from Cold Spring with his technical report, technical question. So go right ahead with your space report, Paul.
Okay, 2J, I'm done.
Very good. Nice to know. And it looks like all the links are working. Thank you. I presume you're up at Glen Oaks, is that true?
Yes, sir.
So right now you are, what, roughly 330 feet above the ground?
No, I just came down. I'm in the car.
Okay. I thought you were high. Go right ahead, Paul. WS2N with the space report. K2RIW.
Okay, very good. Well, right from the beginning, today's news was about Alan Bean, the astronaut that was the fourth man to land on the moon. Unfortunately, he passed away, it looks like yesterday, at 86 years old. But he was quite a guy. He was famous for being an artist, really, for most of his life, and he had a lot of pictures that, you know, paintings that he made having to do with the space program. But now he's passed on. It only leaves, I was counting him up earlier today, two astronauts that have actually walked on the moon that are still alive, and Dave Scott, and there was one other one there. He was a scientist, Evans, Evans was in the command module, Schmidt, Harrison Schmidt. So they were all moving on. I was hoping a couple of them would be around the next time we go back to the moon so that they can interview them and talk about it when that happens.
So to review, I think a total of 12 astronauts have walked on the moon. Let's see now, six total missions. Apollo 11, 12, 14, 15, 16, and 17. So six missions. Two guys of the three on each mission walk on the moon. 12 astronauts have walked on the moon. Of those 12, I guess, I think you're saying, I think I read that eight of them have died. You think only two of them are alive. Oh, well. I'm back to you for updating all this, Paul. WS2N, K2IW.
Okay, we'll have to check. Let's see. You know, some of them were in command modules, like Mattingly, you know, he was in the command module. He's still alive. And, but as far as I know, Dave Scott is still around. His partner was Irwin. He was the first one to pass away many, many years ago. And then Apollo 17, we just lost Cernan, and now we have Evans. Let me drop it a second. So, that's the deal on that. But, yeah, we could, I could Google all of these, but I'm pretty sure they're the only two that are left. Yeah, you're right, there was six missions that actually landed like you said, 11, 12, 14, 15, 16, and 17. There were a couple more scheduled after that were all canceled due to the budget. So. Back to Alan Bean, though, he was on that Apollo 12 mission. That was his first flight. That was the one where they had lightning hit it as he was taking off, and lightning followed the exhaust of
of the Saturn V all the way down to the ground. And they lost some, quite a few circuit breakers went off, and they had to reset them to get going. Alan Bean knew, you know, he memorized where everything was. You know, he was instrumental in getting that mission successfully into orbit. And then he followed that mission up with Skylab. He was the commander of one of the Skylab missions. Skylab is like a forgotten program among a lot of people. And actually four launches for that. Let me drop it. He was Skylab 3. The first one was Skylab 1. That was unmanned. That actually launched Skylab, and then Skylab 2. And then Skylab 3, which he was on, and it was one that came after him. By the way, one of the people he went up on to Skylab was Garriott, the guy that you know, that you spoke to on ham radio when he did a flight on a shuttle. I believe that was. That predated what they do today. The missions on, for the Ares, the amateur radio on the International Space Station. I think it was called the SARex, Shuttle Amateur Radio Experiment. So, let me drop it. This is WS2M. Last week, actually, it was last Sunday. Yeah, 7 days ago, they launched the Cygnus Antares rocket from Virginia, from Wallops Island. And Antares is the rocket with the RD 181 engines, the new engines that they use. And when I say they, I mean Orbital ATK. They're the ones that built the Cygnus spacecraft and the Antares rocket. And that successfully got to orbit, and eventually a couple of days later, docked with the ISS. And they wound up getting all their supplies delivered, 7,000, I think they said 7,400 pounds, which is a lot more than they used to. The earlier Cygnus flights used to carry like 4,000, but like I said, they have bigger engines now, able to carry more load. And Cygnus is very versatile. When Orbital ATK had a problem back in 2014 with their earlier Antares rocket, and it blew up after it launched right above the launch pad, they still had this multi-billion-dollar contract with NASA to deliver the goods. So what they did is they contracted the ULA, that's the United Launch Alliance, that's two companies, Boeing and Lockheed, that are involved with that. And they're the ones that launch most of the rockets for NASA. You know, they'll launch the Delta II, the Delta IV, they'll launch the Atlas V. Well, they made a deal with Orbital ATK to launch the Cygnus spacecraft, and they did that a couple of times. They adapted it. Well, it was actually figured out when they engineered it to be able to switch between the different rockets. So they were able to put it onto the top of an Atlas V rocket, which they did a couple of times. And Atlas V is much more powerful than the Antares rocket, so they were able to get over 7,000 pounds up on each flight instead of the 4,000 pounds plus. But as time went on and Orbital ATK fixed their problems with the old engines, they had NK-33 Russian engines that were problematic. They replaced them with the RD-181s, and they're much more powerful. And they also now have a better upper stage, Castor 30 rocket that they use for their second stage is much more powerful than it used to be. So now they're up to over almost 7,500 pounds per flight. you'll notice that SpaceX, when they launched their Dragon, the payload is a little bit less. They don't get quite that much. You know, they're in the 6,000-pound range. And the reason for that is twofold, is they have a big heat shield on there. The Dragon is the only vehicle that comes back with cargo on it all the way back to eventually landing. They land in the Pacific Ocean. You know, they have a heat shield, parachutes, and then they SpaceX picks them up and brings them to shore. That heat shield has weight to it. And also the parachutes, you know, you have to have a compartment for the parachutes. I mean, parachutes are very, very heavy. So that's why, you know, you can bring up, you know, a lot more cargo with the Antares rocket. Also with the Japanese, when they launch there, they have an HTV vehicle with cargo, a lot more weight packed. I think they get up to 10,000 pounds. But again, it stays docked to the International Space Station, and they fill it up with junk, and eventually burns up over the Pacific Ocean. So that's the story on Cygnus. Successful launch. It'll stay docked for a couple of months to the space station, and eventually undock. And when they do, they have a couple of CubeSats that are still attached to the Cygnus spacecraft, and on the way back, it will deploy them. So that worked out okay. Another launch that just went up last week was the GRACE follow-on mission. They call it a GRACE acronym for Gravity Recovery Climate Experiment Follow-on Mission. It's actually a follow-up mission of a previous GRACE mission that was launched about 10 years ago. Actually, a little longer than that, but you had these two satellites following one another for many years, and they were the first GRACE missions to go to Earth orbit. And
Talking 375 cut out.
Measure the gravity for the whole Earth at that different time, and they would be able to tell where we're losing water or where we're gaining water, if the glacier disappeared or something like that. They would be able to figure that out, and they did successfully. They call that the GRACE mission. Now this is the GRACE FO, or follow-on mission. The first two have eventually concluded, so they deorbited those two, and now they launch these two. They're now successfully in orbit. SpaceX launched them with a combination of another flight. They were launching Iridium flights. The Iridium flight missions were, in this case, five Iridium satellites that were going up. SpaceX keeps launching Iridium. They've launched 10 at a time, usually. But this was five because they were adding two of these NASA slash Germany, by the way, involved with these GRACE missions. Into that same flight, they launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base. Successful launch. They first got rid of the GRACE satellites because they were on top, and then they relit their Merlin engine to increase the their altitude. GRACE flies around 300 miles, and then the two Iridium satellites go a couple hundred miles higher than that. So that's the story on that. We had another similar mission using the same technology, and they sent it to the moon a few years back. two satellites flying, in that case, over the moon. They sent it into a polar orbit, and they measured the gravity at the different locations on the moon. They wanted to find out more accurate information about the mass cons, mass concentrations of gravity on the moon. And it turns out the GRAIL system that they used was excellent. They followed one another. They gave them names, some kids named it Evan, I forget. But the two satellites would measure the distance between one another, and if one pulled ahead and the other one didn't, that meant there was more gravity in the lunar area, in that area, and then eventually the second one would go by, and that would speed up and eventually catch up to the other one. And they would stay about 100 miles behind one another, a little longer than 100 miles. What happened was they used 30 gigahertz to check the accuracy between the satellites. And the same with the GRAIL mission, and the one that we just went up on last week. And by having that kind of accuracy, you think that was good. They just duplicated the 30 gigahertz. Still not good enough. Let's make it even more accurate. They put laser beams on these two. They have laser beams pointing at each other. And
I'm listening to the link frequency, and I don't hear it on, so that's why probably this thing is cut out of the system. You can't hear 85 at all up there directly from Glen Oaks, huh?
Diameter of a hair.
Hey guys, do you mind?
It's down in the noise level.
No.
I have to put up the Yagi if I want to be able to hear that directly.
So that's the deal on that. I was going to talk about another mission. The last couple of weeks I was going to talk about this thing, but kind of gotten away from me, so I think it's a good time to do that, because now there's another rover planned on being launched. We always talk about the 2020 rover that NASA is going to be sending up in 2020. By the way, it doesn't have a name yet, but there is another one that the European Space Agency is also going to launch in 2020, and it's called the ExoMars mission. ExoMars is a mission, the size of it is probably be about one-third the weight and size of the 2020 rover that NASA is sending up. But this is a joint venture between Roscosmos, Roscosmos is the Russian equivalent of NASA, and the European Space Agency. They plan on launching this from Russia on a Proton rocket. And NASA is involved with this. NASA is sending the life science piece up with it. It's called MOMA, M-O-M-A. And that involves this gadget that's attached to the rover that will turn 90 degrees, point straight down, and drill 6 feet into the ground, 2 meters into the ground. And then withdraw that drill and eventually take samples from it, and they're going to have a chemistry lab on board and all. So NASA is supplying that. Originally they weren't involved with it, actually, as a couple of years ago. When this all was planned originally, yes, NASA was heavily involved. They were even going to launch with an Atlas V rocket, but things changed, and economy stepped in, and eventually you wound up with a Mars rover, ExoMars rover. It's going to be solar powered, built by European Space Agency, launched by Russia, with the piece of machinery on board. There's a little laboratory on board that's going to be built by NASA. So that'll be interesting. I'd like to see that thing land. European Space Agency and Russia have had some problems landing. satellites involved with this. One, they had the Trace Orbiter that is now successfully in orbit around Mars. A couple years ago, they successfully did that. The European Space Agency is very happy about that. They're detecting different gases such as methane, and the scientists are doing studies with the Tracer orbiter. But with that mission attached to Trace, they also sent a lander in called Schiaparelli. And Schiaparelli separated from the Trace, and you might remember it was in the news, and it was supposed to land, had lithium batteries in there, and it was going to last, you know, a day on Mars or something. But it wound up getting close to the surface and wound up crashing into the planet. It just didn't work out. So they learned a lot from it, something to do with the radar or whatever it was. But whatever it is, they're correcting for that, and they hope they don't have that problem with this lander that I believe Russia is flying. So that's pretty much it for now. The other missions that are up there are doing good. InSight is still doing good with its two following spacecraft, Marco. They've made mid-course corrections successfully. So the day after Thanksgiving, which is the 26th of November, you're going to have the InSight mission, that's a NASA mission, land around the equator of Mars. Actually, not too far from Curiosity, where Curiosity is now, a couple hundred miles away. And another mission that's also doing very good is Juno. Juno is still in orbit around Jupiter, doing its science, and I saw a nice picture of it the other day. It was actually taken from Juno as it was leaving the planet. It goes about, I don't know, 10 or 12 diameters away from Jupiter for every orbit, and then comes back, so it takes like 53 days for every orbit. They had a nice picture leaving the South Pole, looking back at the planet, and you can see the red spot. That was pretty good. So a lot of missions are still doing good, and the only one that's having problems, Dick, is the one that you're talking about with the camera, with the GOES, and the future GOES mission that might be going up might be delayed. Otherwise, I think they're all doing pretty good. I know China launched their mission. I'm still trying to get an update on that. That was called the Chang-4. They did that last week, and that's on the way to the moon, and that's going to be a repeater in space. It's going to be 40,000 miles away from the moon, in the Earth-Moon Lagrange point, number two, and it's going to just sit there, hopefully for the next couple of years. They want it to last like 3 years as a communications device for a future lander that's going up in November. Let me drop it. Yeah, Chang-4 lander will have a rover, and they plan on landing not on the near side of the moon, but the far side of the moon. And because of the X-band, I understand they want to communicate in X-band, but whatever it is, your signals aren't going to go around the moon. They don't have an atmosphere on there, so they can't depend on an ionosphere. They have to have a satellite permanently put into position, and that's what this mission was. Still trying to get an update and see how it's doing, and I believe there's a couple of amateur radio frequencies involved too. I'll have to eventually look into that, where amateurs wouldn't be able to hear it on UHF, I believe. That's it, Dick, for now. Any questions? We'll be here, K2RIW, WS2N, for the Space Report.